I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Dr. Stephen Windmuller, former dean of Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles, and a leading scholar and analyst of the Federation Movement, as well as current American Jewish trends. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Europe has been in the news the last few weeks with Greece on perpetual bankruptcy watch and the accumulation of anti-Semitic incidents over the past year all over the continent, creating the impression that this is 1938 all over again. We'll talk about this in various ways over the course of our Two Jewish show this morning, but I want to weigh in a bit on the country that has attracted the worst attention for a rising climate of anti-Semitism, France. We've heard about legions of French Jews, the largest Jewish community in Europe, purchasing homes in Israel or preparing to flee en masse. But while there have been terrible terror attacks in France in the past year, particularly the gruesome murders of so many at the Charlie Hebdo magazine at the end of last year, and there are continuing reports of attacks on individuals and fear among Jewish residents of France, the official position of the French government and of the vast majority of French citizens has been overwhelming support for the Jewish citizens of France and condemnation of anti-Semitism. And you know, this makes sense. Although the French are prone to anti-Semitism, like most Europeans over the course of years, France was the first European country to guarantee full citizenship to Jews, including freedom and the rights that every citizen should have. And the great hero of Jewish emancipation in Europe was actually Napoleon Bonaparte, who broke down the walls of the ghettos all over Europe and brought Jews into the European mainstream around 1800. France has had Jewish presidents, generals, painters, and poets, illustrious citizens of all ranks. And while the influx of a Muslim underclass threatens to unbalance French society today, in general, Jews have thrived in modern France. So even though things may seem less than optimal for our people in France today, it is going to be the 14th of July in 2 days, Bastille Day in France, their Independence Day dating back to the year 1789, not so long after ours. And we should celebrate the first nation to fully emancipate its Jews. It has become a tradition here on Two Jewish to ring in Bastille Day with the late, great Alan Sherman's classic song, You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis.
Louis the 16th was the king of France in 1789. He was worse than Louis the 15th. He was worse than Louis the 14th. He was worse than Louis the 13th. He was the worst since Louis the 1st. King Louis was living like a king, but the people were living rotten. So the people, they started an uprising, which they called the French Revolution. And of course, you remember their battle cry, which will never be forgotten. You went the wrong way, old King Louis. The population cried, 'cause all you did was sit and pet with Marie Antoinette in your place at Versailles. And now the country's gone kablooey, so we are giving you the air that ought to teach you not to spend all your time fooling round at the Folies Bergère. If you had been a nicer king, we wouldn't do a thing.
but you were bad, you must admit. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine and shorten you a little bit. You came the wrong way, old King Louis, and now you ain't got far to go. Too bad you won't be here to see that great big Eiffel Tower or Brigitte Bardot. To you, King Louis, we say fooey. You disappointed all of France. But then what else could we expect from a king in silk stockings and pink satin pants? You filled your stomach with chop suey and also crepe Suzette's and steak. And when they told your wife Marie that nobody had bread, she said, let them eat cake. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine. It's somewhere in the heart of town. And when that fella there is through with what he's gonna do, you'll have no place to wear your crown. You came the wrong way, old King Louis. Now we must put you on the shelf. That's why the people are revolting, 'cause Louis, you're pretty revolting yourself.
That was Alan Sherman's wonderful You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis, helping celebrate Bastille Day this coming Tuesday, July 14th. May be a better year for French Jews and for freedom in Europe. When we return in a few moments here on Two Jewish, we'll meet our guest, Dr. Stephen Windmuller, who has been a Federation leader, the Dean of Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles, a scholar of the Jewish community of America, and the author of books on that community and on the political affiliations and dedications of American Jews. Find out what his latest research shows when we come back in a few moments here on Two Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Stephen Windmuller. Dr. Windmuller served as the dean of the Los Angeles campus of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion for about 4 or 5 years, but he has served many other functions within the Jewish community of the United States as an expert on the Federation movement and on politics in Judaism, has a couple of books out, including one called The Quest for Power from 2014, A Study in Jewish Political Behavior. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
So, you have an article that came out recently, the foreword, about the future of the Jewish Federation movement. I think that while most Jews know the Federation exists and some are deeply enmeshed in it, there's lots of Jews who have no idea what the Jewish Federation actually is or was or what it might become. Can you just clarify that for our listeners?
Sure. Toward the end of the 19th century, the American Jewish community began to form these clusters or federations of community agencies and social services, first in Boston and then in Cincinnati in the 1890s. But then ultimately, most or all of American Jewish communities would have in the 20th century these institutions that sort of helped to set the planning, fundraising, and organizational structure of the community together, bringing it together. And they have been extremely successful because they were designed basically to manage crises and to manage needs of the Jewish community. So with the Russian pogroms, the First World War, the Holocaust, the emergence of the State of Israel, Soviet Jewry, and other crises, the federated system really was quite responsive and successful in mobilizing the community, raising funds to support Jewish needs, both within the communities and across the world.
So as somebody who grew up in the 1960s and 70s, and I guess 80s to a degree, to me, the Federation was the fundraising organization that was always raising money for Israel. It has changed its priorities dramatically over the years. Can you address that just a little bit?
Sure. And you're absolutely correct. In the years certainly between 1945 and 1981-82, we saw a clear growth of support for Israel in the efforts by federations to be the principal framework for raising monies for the United Jewish Appeal, which at the time was a separate entity which was receiving allocations from our federations in support of the social service needs, the infrastructural needs of the State of Israel. And that arrangement worked particularly well in each of the critical years of Israel's early life, 1948 and its founding, 1967 and the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War of the 1973 period, and again for the Peace for Galilee campaign in the early 1980s. And in each of those succeeding efforts or campaigns, the federations would grow their capacity or their ability to raise monies so that somewhere between 75 and in some communities as much as 90% of the dollars raised were being earmarked for Israel through the UJA. That, of course, has radically changed. And that is in part why I think there are today conversations about the changing sort of character and nature of the federations and its place or role in American Jewish life.
And we will certainly explore that when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish with our guest, Dr. Steve Windmuller.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Visit our website, toojewishradio.com, where you can stream all past and present shows, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. You know, we have 16 more months to go until the election for President of the United States, but it's better to be early than late, and so we continue our special election year or so feature, the 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. We offer in-depth coverage, unusual features, and the finest opinion available on the air as we choose the new leader for our nation. With the field of contestants for President of the U.S. now swollen to a very Jewish-sounding 18, Remember, only one person can be president at a time. Speculation began about an ever-popular subject. Will this finally be the election when Jews stop voting for Democratic candidates for president? In the past three decades of presidential voting, going back to 1984, the Jewish vote has always been between 64 and 80% in favor of the Democratic candidate. And, well, not in favor of the Republican candidate. In fact, to find an election in which a Republican candidate for president drew as much as 39% of the Jewish vote, you have to go all the way back to Ronald Reagan defeating Jimmy Carter in 1980. And then, even the highly unpopular among Jews, Carter, received 45% of the Jewish vote, more than Reagan. While there are certainly fissures between President Obama and the American Jewish community on issues like the nuclear deal with Iran, it seems unlikely that this election will change this foundational aspect of the American electorate. This has been true, well, since Franklin Delano Roosevelt drew close to 90% in his elections for president. The truth is, this Jewish preference for the Democratic Party will only matter significantly if the state of Florida again becomes a determining swing state in the election in 2016, because we Jews are about 3% of the U.S. population. Not so many. And although we vote at a very high level, we live in highest proportions in essentially uncontested states like New York, California, New Jersey, and Illinois. Only Florida, among the places where Jews live most, has the potential to come down to a swing in the Jewish vote. Although many American Jews are less than thrilled with the Obama administration, it seems very unlikely that enough will leave the Democratic fold to make a significant difference in 2016. That was our 2016 presidential election update from a Jewish perspective. Only 16 months to go. I can hardly wait. We welcome our Mivinan, Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You know, Israeli politics have had women in prominent roles for a long time. Everybody knows Golda Meir was the prime minister of Israel. America has never had a woman president so far. But then people say, oh, it probably just Golda Meir, and there's never been other prominent women in Israeli politics. That's not true at all.
No, actually, even earlier, we can talk about this government, but even an earlier government, like 20 years ago, we had like the Minister of Health was a woman, and the Minister of Justice was a woman. And in this government, even though it's very narrow, 61 members of the government, sorry, 61
members
member
of the
coalition.
Yeah. Sometimes it feels like there's 61 ministers, but it's not quite that.
Yeah, so we have Minister of Justice. She's Ayelet Shaked, very young.
I think kind of a star, isn't she?
Kind of a star from Israel Beitenu. And you know, I heard her a few, I think it was last week, she had her first interview. And as a member of Knesset, she was like fighter. And then now she's more, you know, thinking about what words she will say. And it was almost 20 minutes of interview. And then at the end, the interviewer asked her, did you receive any tips? And she said, yes. One, and the important one was to consider my words in an interview. So it was very nice. And also the Minister of Culture, Miri Regev, is a woman. But yeah, we have a strong women's holds a very strong position in the Knesset and in the government and in the coalition.
Well,
may I say thanks God.
You can indeed. And it's fascinating because we tend to perceive Israel as a more traditional society. After all, many people are immigrants, first generation immigrants from very traditional places where women wouldn't have such prominent roles. So it's fascinating to see the integration has proceeded at really quite a rapid pace. So when's the next? There was almost a second Israeli prime minister, Tzipi Livni, who couldn't quite pull together the coalition, and Netanyahu formed the coalition and has stayed in power ever since. Who's the next woman prime minister of Israel?
You know, you can say a lot of things about me, but I'm not a prophet. But also, I can also say that I think what plays a main role of women being main player, prominent. Yeah. It's the IDF, because it doesn't matter where you grew up and whatever your background. As soon as you came to the army, to the Israeli, and it's mandatory, so everyone will go, even those who, you know, didn't know they have a huge potential of leadership, and then they will find in the army that they are great leaders, and then they will, you know. So I think it's the tipping point. It's the IDF service.
Fascinating. Thanks very much, Oshrat. We will talk next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Anti-Semitism is on the rise in Europe. We hear a lot in the press and in discussion. It may not be so much that anti-Semitism is on the rise, but that the demographics in Europe have changed. Let's talk about that.
Well, I think you're right to point out that there are significant demographic changes in Europe. And I get sort of annoyed when American Jews panic over what they see as a sharp increase in anti-Semitism among the French or the Germans or the Danes or whomever, because it's not really among those people. It's among the growing Arab population in those countries, which in some countries like France has reached 20%. So it's a very significant minority. In Germany, the Muslim population is much more divided between Turks,
of course,
and Arabs, right, and probably some Pakistanis and others. So it's more diverse. And I think that the phenomenon that looks to many Americans like increasing anti-Semitism in Europe is in fact an expression of increasing percentages of Arabs in countries like France and Belgium and even Holland and Denmark. And that demographic change poses a lot of problems for authorities, whether in terms of security, education, even healthcare, because the Arab populations have values that are very different. They are different in appearance. There's controversies over head coverings. There's all kinds of issues, even basic civil liberties issues, which European societies value on the one hand, but there's also a strong sense in Europe that there's a European identity. And one of the issues over which the whole idea of adopting a constitution for the European Union has repeatedly foundered is, does the European identity include a Christian element? In other words, do you have to be Christian to be a true European? Well, Christians have long since conceded that there's a Judeo-Christian tradition that includes both, and that we're sort of brother and sister. And the current Pope has made a big deal of this and has extended reconciliation much further than any of his predecessors, even as recently as last week.
Yeah, extraordinary.
But on the other hand, when you bring Muslims into the equation, and particularly Arabs, there's this whole other dimension. There's the whole history of the rivalry between European Christians and Asian Muslims, particularly Arabs. And I think we have to view the rise in anti-Semitism through that prism. And we need probably to talk more next week about the phenomenon of revanchisme, of getting revenge for the lost provinces, in quotation marks, of the old Arab Empire.
Yeah, fascinating how history comes back around. We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish Humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Young Dr. Levine, who has replaced the recently retired Dr. Cohen, comes into the room and sees his elderly patient, Mrs. Goldberg. As he looks through Mrs. Goldberg's chart, he's startled to see that his predecessor has prescribed birth control pills for her, and that she is in his office specifically to get her prescription renewed. Mrs. Goldberg, the young doctor says, do you realize these are birth control pills? You're in your 80s. Why do you have them? Well, doctor, she says, they help me sleep better at night. Dr. Levine answers, I can assure you there is absolutely nothing in birth control pills that could possibly help you sleep better at night. When she hears this, Mrs. Goldberg reaches over, gently, patronizingly pats Dr. Levine on the knee and says, ah, yes, they do. I get up very early, every morning, grind up the pills, mix one or two into the orange juice I give my 16-year-old granddaughter. Believe me, doctor, this helps me sleep much better at night. That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. This week we read the double portion of Matot Maaseh, the last sections of the Book of Numbers, Bamidbar. Both portions teach an important message about the centrality of Jewish family values, but they do so in different ways. The setting for these final parshiot in Numbers is the border of the Promised Land. The Israelites approach Canaan for a second time after their 40-year sojourn in the wilderness of Sinai. As the tribes gather to enter the land, two of them, Reuben and Gad, make a strange request of Moses. We like the land we're traveling through now, they say, here on the east bank of the Jordan. That is today the country of Jordan, but long before the Arab peoples moved into the Middle East. The leaders of Reuben and Gad then say, let us stay here and build sheepfolds for our flocks and towns for our children. Moses agrees, but in very interesting language. First he tells them, build the towns for your children, only then build the sheepfolds for your flocks. The message is clear. Families come first, our professions and income second. It is a human message and one that we need to relearn in every generation. Put family first. Then in the very last section of Numbers, called Maaseh, an important and unusual institution is created, the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts were common, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was accomplished by the family of the victim directly. Vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption caused by killing. If you killed someone intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of a person who was killed just thought you had committed that killing, you would likely be killed in turn by their kin. Which meant that if you were involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing was accidental and even if you were innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, it wouldn't help. This kind of reprisal killing also could and did lead to cycles of revenge, the sort of blood feud that Mark Twain captured when he described the Hatfields and the McCoys several millennia later, the kind of clan murder that takes place even today, Palestinian Arab towns in Gaza and the West Bank. To preclude this social disaster in the portion of Maaseh, the Torah provides for six cities of refuge. They are to be created in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters these cities may be executed without a fair trial. Being present in the city of refuge is a kind of protection, the guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law, but it was mostly absent through human history. Yet the Torah established that principle 3,000 years ago. Whether it did so to protect innocents accused of murder or just to keep families from falling into cycles of revenge, the message was clear. The most basic unit of society has to be nurtured, maintained, and protected, its positive values strengthened, always in even the most trying situations. Again, putting family first. A great message for us today. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Dr. Stephen Windmuller, the Rabbi Alfred Gottschalk Emeritus Professor in Jewish Communal Studies at Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles, a former dean there, a longtime leader, an acute observer of the world of the Federation and the American Jewish community in general. Find out what he recommends to restore the relevance of the Federation and where he thinks the American Jewish polity is going when we come back in a few moments here on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A poll released last week found that European countries that were the scenes of attacks against Jews in 2014 or 2015 have experienced a notable drop in anti-Semitism due to increased public awareness and strong government response. In France, 37% of the population held anti-Semitic views in a survey conducted in May of 2014 by the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL. But following the murder of four people in January at the hyper-kasher supermarket in Paris, that number dropped 20 points to just 17%. Similarly, in Belgium, where an Arab terrorist murdered four people at a Jewish museum in Brussels in May of 2014, the proportion of those holding anti-Semitic views dropped from 27 to 21%. In Germany, which was the site last summer of an attack on a synagogue and anti-Semitic chanting during protests against the Gaza war, the number fell to 16% from 27%. A striking difference from previous anti-Semitism in Europe has been the swift condemnations of governments from Paris to Berlin to Brussels, accompanied in some cases by the deployment of thousands of troops to protect Jewish institutions, said Abe Foxman, the ADL's national director in America and a past guest of Too Jewish. Government responses to anti-Semitic manifestations, violence, and death have a positive impact on anti-Semitic attitudes, Foxman said. People are always cynical. Does it really matter what the government says? How significant is that? We have always believed it does make a difference. The results come from a follow-up to the landmark survey on global anti-Semitism the ADL held in May of 2014. That initial survey asked people in 101 countries plus the Palestinian territories whether they agreed with 11 negative statements about Jews, such as Jews have too much power in the business world. If they endorsed six or more of the statements, they were considered to harbor anti-Semitic views. In the earlier survey, 26% of those surveyed around the world fell into this category. The follow-up poll this spring was more limited, included 19 countries, and its most notable finding was a drop in anti-Semitic views in countries that had experienced dramatic anti-Jewish events. In Denmark, scene of another much-publicized attack where a man was murdered at a Copenhagen synagogue in February, those with anti-Semitic attitudes dipped from an already very low 9% down to 8%. The public and official reaction to the wave of anti-Semitic episodes this year and last was dramatic. In France, the shooting at the hyper-cachère supermarket, part of a terrorist spree that killed a dozen people at the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, prompted widespread discussion and a national identity crisis. Millions of people, including world leaders, attended rallies in Paris and elsewhere in France in solidarity with the victims. The new poll shows that 80% of French people followed news related to the anti-Semitic attacks, and 55% said they'd talked about that violence against Jews with family or friends. France is home both to Europe's largest Jewish population and its largest Muslim community. Germany has also wrestled with the recent anti-Semitism, given its history during World War II and the Holocaust, of course. In the summer of 2014, about a year ago, German protests against the Israeli incursion in Gaza erupted periodically into anti-Semitic chanting, and a synagogue was firebombed in the town of Wuppertal. No one was killed in the German incidents, but such events have greater historical resonance in Germany. As Foxman says, the antennae vibrate more significantly and seriously in Germany when a synagogue is touched or desecrated. German Chancellor Angela Merkel spoke emotionally at a rally against anti-Semitism at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin in September of 2014, saying it was our national and civic duty to fight anti-Jewish prejudice. Some dark spots in Europe persist. Greece, in the midst of enormous economic, social, and political turmoil, continues to have the highest level of anti-Semitism in Europe, 67% holding such views, down just slightly from 69% in 2014. And European Muslims were found to accept anti-Semitic stereotypes at a far higher rate than other Europeans, 55% on average. This was still a lower rate than the 75% of Muslims in the Middle East and North Africa who embrace those views. This is something one needs to be aware of and concerned about, Foxman said. They come with this baggage, and while the European environment lowers the level, it doesn't lower it as much as the rest of the local population. Overall, the survey suggests that the violent attacks have prompted a sense of solidarity with Jews on the part of residents of the countries where they happen. Asked about the assertion that violence against Jews in this country affect everyone and is an attack on our way of life, large majorities agree, 78% in Germany, 77% in France, and 68% in Belgium.
Now I had the time of my life. No, I never felt like this before. Yes, I swear it's a truth. And I owe it all to you.
Cause I had the time of my life, and I owe it all to you.
In a transformation that would normally only take place in the movies, one of the great Catskills resorts, Kutcher's, is going to become something, well, quite different. It closed in 2013. And now the former Borscht Belt Hotel, famed as the inspiration for the fictional Dirty Dancing Resort from the movie, will be reincarnated as a $250 million yoga center. Indian billionaire Subhash Chandra plans to turn the defunct resort into a yoga and wellness center. His vision edged closer to becoming reality when he attended the groundbreaking last week for a 260,000-square-foot site. Kutcher's opened back in 1907. It was a haven for Jews shut out of Gentile vacation clubs through the middle of the 20th century. It's known to Jews and non-Jews alike as the inspiration for Kellerman's, the fictional resort that was the setting of the classic 1987 Patrick Swayze film Dirty Dancing. Construction of the new center will take around 18 months. Once open, week-long packages could cost about $2,000. Chandra plans to open four more similar centers across the U.S. This center is based upon Ayurvedic principles, one of which is healthy eating. Boy, that's a little different from the way they used to eat in the Catskills. It's It's a very well-known fact that this country needs help in the health and wellness space, Chandra, who is worth more than $2 billion, said. I hope I'm not politically wrong mentioning that. No, it bears mentioning. Even at the former site of Kutcher's, where profoundly unhealthy, heavy Jewish food was supplied in gigantic portions in years past, along with large helpings of canasta. But now, only healthy food and lots of yoga.
It's a fantastic start by the USA. Lloyd with Morgan streaking. She's chipping the goalkeeper! Off the post and in! Hat trick for Lloyd!
And finally, the Women's World Cup concluded last week. The U.S. won the greatest championship in women's soccer in the world, its third World Cup in history, with a 5-2 victory over Japan. Carly Lloyd was the star, scoring 3 goals early in the match to put it away, but you probably don't know that the 32-year-old soccer sensation owes much of her success to a Jewish guy named Rudy Klobach, her high school coach, a Holocaust survivor. Klobach was born in 1944 in Theresienstadt camp. His father, Carl, was forced to bury bodies of fellow Jewish prisoners. After the war, the family moved to Dusseldorf and then to the U.S. when young Rudy was just 4. Over 20 years as a New Jersey girls soccer coach, Klobach coached teams to 256 wins. In 2011, he was named to the South Jersey Soccer Hall of Fame. But no one meant as much to him as midfielder Carly Lloyd, whom he coached from 1997 to 2000. Klobach watched her rise to high school star status and go on to win 2 Olympic gold medals. After every win, he exclaimed, "That's my girl." Sadly, he wasn't there to see her ascend to sports legend status during last week's final. Klobach died in January after a 3-year battle with Lou Gehrig's disease. He was never surprised at her success because she had always been so driven, his wife, Barbara Klobach, said. He liked coaching her because Carly was so serious about the game. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Stephen Windmuller, who has a distinguished career in the Jewish Federation world, Jewish communal world, and in academia as well. A past dean of the Los Angeles campus of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. He received an honorary degree from there pretty recently and has worked extensively studying and serving the Jewish community of America for, I don't want to mention how many years, if that's okay with you. And his book, The Quest for Power, Jewish Political Behavior, is fascinating and interesting and very relevant. Steve, we were talking earlier about the change in the Federation movement that began in the 1980s when Israel stopped being a poor country desperately in need of financial assistance from the United States, or at least from the Jews of the world, to something more stable and solid, and the Federation began to look for other directions. Is that a fair assessment?
That is, and I think we need to add maybe a couple of other elements to what was happening in the 1980s that sort of transitioned the community and the federated system. First, we would begin to see the rise of alternative resources in the Jewish community. Family foundations were beginning to appear. A transfer of wealth from one generation to another was ultimately beginning in the 1980s. We would see a shift also in some of the core agreements or shared understandings about Israel, tensions over the who is a Jew question, issues about Israeli policy on settlements, debates about Israel's relationships to its neighbors, would all spark a kind of transitional response or behavior on the part of Jewish donors, looking for alternative ways possibly to express themselves, or by federations, in fact, taking steps to change some of their focus to appeal to the generational and demographic changes that were occurring.
So all of that led to some kind of... In any kind of change like this, there's going to be some casting about for new directions. Some of them will be successful, some won't. Bringing us up to date, what have federations done well? In what areas have they fallen out of currency? Can you explore some of that in a global way?
Right, and very clearly, there are 120 or more Jewish federations in the United States. So to make a kind of generic commentary on the federation movement or the system is certainly not fair, nor is it necessarily going to be accurate.
Well, it's almost a little bit like talking about how synagogues are functioning in America today.
Exactly. So you do have very successful models, and you have other conditions or communities in which the federations are really struggling to figure out their voice. Some federations have really focused on their local communities, earmarking dollars and attention to specific needs of those communities, whether it's in young leadership, Jewish education, Jews in crisis and need, whether it has to do with innovation and reaching sort of the unaffiliated. So you have a whole array of these initiatives designed to spark new programming and alternative funding to create, in a sense, responses to what donors and the communities are telling us. As Jewish consumers, I think many Jews have lost some of their passion and interest for some of the centralized forms of giving. So where federations had in the 1980s and 90s, you know, maybe 900,000 donors nationally, those numbers have radically fallen. So where today we probably have 400,000 or maybe less of American Jews who are actually annual donors to our federations.
Now, wow.
I know there are efforts at growing that or regrowing that, and some successful and some still struggling. But what we're basically seeing is a loss of half of the
donor base
right. Jewish, of the donor base of federations. And that is a telling statement about the fact that as individuals, we make choices about where our dollars are going, whether directly to a social service agency, which once might have been a major recipient of a federation, or because we have an interest in a particular cause, whether it's Israel-based or educationally oriented or environmentally of interest. The fact is Jews today are a people of choice in terms of being able to designate the kinds of giving that they may wish to do. And so federations have got to figure out ways by which to reconnect and attract that base of donors that both they have lost and a new generation of donors that they now need to bring to the table.
So to me, the principal purpose or the organizational backing, really the raison d'etre for federations is they have to raise money. Right? I mean, aren't they essentially fundraising organizations at heart? If they don't raise funds, then they don't have the ability to distribute funds or form that kind of leadership?
Well, certainly that is one of the core sort of principles upon which the system is based. The second, however, is less about fundraising and more about building community, and that has to do with the notion, as referenced in the article in the Jewish Forward of last week, where we talk about the big tent and the notion that nowhere in the Jewish community are we holding today conversations that bring the various diverse voices of the community together. And it is, in our view, an essential ingredient of strong Jewish communities that they are able to at least have conversations, if not full agreement, on what the core issues and interests are of the Jewish community. And what better institution than the Jewish Federation to, in a sense, grow and frame that kind of conversation and discourse that so desperately is absent in many parts of the Jewish community?
So, and everyone's experience of federation, except maybe yours, is localized. If all politics is local, federation work is local, as you noted. So, you know, in my experience, you will have federation events that are geared towards people with a certain perspective on Israel, for example, and then another event that might be geared towards people with a different perspective, but you rarely find that big tent existing in the same place, if that makes any sense. Is that a challenge?
Oh, absolutely. And you're absolutely correct in terms of the observations that, in a sense, we've become silo Jewish communities where we tend to speak with those who share our either political, religious, or social agendas, and we don't seem to find ways to sort of cross those boundaries where once we were able to carry those conversations with civility across the table. And I think that's one of the principles here of reactivating, if you wish, the role of the JCRCs or the role of federations in its largest sense of being the community convener.
So I'll tell you, you know, just sort of some anecdotal experiences. In my synagogue, we've had people who were supporters of the Jewish settler movement, including settlers. We've had Peace Now Knicks talk about Israel. We try to present a very broad spectrum of Jewish perspectives on things, no matter what my own personal views are. I think people should hear from other Jews. I don't see too many Jewish entities doing that, but I think some synagogues can do that. How do synagogues fit into that model with federation?
Well, I think that actually is the possibility of doing things that involve the synagogue community as one of the addresses, as one of the center points for these kinds of conversations to occur. You know, historically, the federation world and the synagogue world were a church-state divide.
Yeah, no fooling.
And in only more recent times, or in the past 40 to 50 years, did we see a growing sort of connection between these two worlds. But this is an extraordinary moment where, in fact, I think the synagogues ought to be seen as partners to federation in especially this kind of work, and also in the efforts of federations to sort of bring Jews who are outside of the community, who are disenchanted with Jewish life, who don't know how to access the Jewish community, who have disagreements in part with Jewish institutions, to figure out ways in which they are invited to a table where they will not be judged, nor will the institutions, in a sense, have to, in a sense, protect or defend themselves, but rather where the conversations are about the substance of what is happening in Jewish life. But as the article itself suggests, we have a stake in the American story. And what better place than the world of the American synagogue or the community to begin to also address the fact, so what do we want America to look like? And what does the Jewish community bring to that conversation? What have we learned about our own immigration story, our own evolution as a community that might have some insights and values to other communities in our own cities and towns, but also to the national debate and conversations about race, immigration, social justice, economic development and opportunity. All of these topics, while of a national scale, certainly have a Jewish component.
I want to thank Dr. Steve Windmuller for a great visit here on Too Jewish. By the way, the article he wrote is called Making the Case for the Big Tent Federation. It's all over the web, and it's a great point about being open to all the different viewpoints in the Jewish community. Thanks so much, Steve. Where can people find out about your book?
Well, The Wind Report is online and has all of my writings, and there's information about ordering the book.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our very special guest will be U.S. Congresswoman Martha McSally, discussing the U.S. relationship with Israel, among other subjects. Our playout this morning is Ki Eshmerah Shabbat. If I observe the Sabbath, God will protect me. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.